Welcome to Strong Tower Radio Today. The views and opinions expressed on this show do not necessarily reflect the views of Strong Tower Radio, West Central Michigan Media Ministries, or its employees.
Welcome to Strong Tower Radio's Good Growing with the Garden Guy, the Strong Tower Radio monthly garden show. Your subject matter expert is Gary Heilig, a retired horticulturist for the Michigan State University Extension Service, a lifelong gardener. Joining me is my sister Sue Majeure. She's an avid gardener researcher, and I'm your host, Tom Majeure. Welcome, Gary.
I'm happy to be here, and it's springtime.
Springtime. Officially, when we're recording it, was 3/21, which, is that the first day of spring?
Well, actually, this year, it was March 20th, because we were in a leap year.
Ah, yes.
So, it was actually yesterday.
All right. You're the expert. That's why I ask you. And Sue, welcome to our program.
Yes. I'm glad to be here, and I'm glad to know that it is officially spring.
That's right. Either one day into it or not, but it's here. Hey, but we're recording this program for a couple weeks from now, and Sue is joining us from Kalamazoo, Michigan. Well, Sue, would you lead us in a word of prayer?
I will. Heavenly Father, thank you for this early spring that we've been enjoying. And the flowers that are coming on, the crocuses and the forsythia and the snowdrops and all the things that are going to come, the tulips, the hyacinths, the lilacs. We all love those things. The rebirth that reminds us of the resurrection that you paid such a high price for us and that we now enjoy. So our gardens can be a reminder of how much you love us, and may we learn more about our gardens to teach us more about you. In Jesus' name, amen.
Amen. Well, Gary, you know, they have Groundhog's Day, and today was my Groundhog Day. Unfortunately, I saw my local groundhog running around today, so I'm not happy at all.
Well, there's not much for him to get into yet, so.
Okay.
Live and let live until then.
Okay, well, but he's still going to be there. Hey, listen, before we start the quiz, I have a question, and this is a travel question. I hope this isn't out of your territory, but I was in Wisconsin yesterday, okay? Mm-hmm. And when I was traveling across the central, northeastern and central part of Wisconsin, I noticed that there were grapevines, you know, they had the grapevine growing up, and then the way they do it now is they have posts, a wooden post, and then a string strung between it is a wire between it, and on that wire there was the vine apparently, but there was a cloth, looked like a black cloth spreading over that. We talked about this before the show, but share with our listeners what you think the purpose of that cloth was.
Well, the other thing I want to ask is, did it look like netting or did it look like a solid fabric?
Looked like a solid fabric. It looked like almost ground cover, a light ground cover fabric.
And it was dark color?
It was black.
Well, one of the things that I think that could be is whenever you put a dark color over something, it absorbs more heat from the sun.
Of course.
And that could accelerate the buds coming out. But you couldn't leave it on there for long periods of time because the plants can't make chlorophyll if they're covered completely. If it was more like a very fine netting, I don't know how close you were, then it would have been to protect the plants as the new shoots come out to keep deer from browsing on them.
Well, I'm probably going back and maybe I'll just go take a look myself.
Yeah, you have to get a closer look to see which one it is.
I'll take a picture and send it to you. Hey, listen, I got a second question from my trip there. And I had a friend going over to help me with what I was doing, and he noticed that in northeastern Wisconsin to central Wisconsin, there were a lot of family farms. He said that back in the day, he was out in Iowa, and many of those family farms were bought up by large farming corporations mm-hmm. and stuff, and all that was left was the house and a small yard and some outbuildings, but it looked like the farms were completely owned by some other corporate entity. But when we were in Wisconsin, it seemed like there was many family farms that looked like they were still active. Any thoughts of why is Wisconsin so appeared to be so hospitable to family farms?
Well, most likely the farms are much more diversified in terms of what they grow and raise in Wisconsin. When you get out to Iowa, they're big in corn. And you need a lot of space for corn because that corn is not only grown for animal feed, but also for ethanol production. And the larger the farm, the better in terms of efficiency.
Yeah, you want wide open spaces.
Mm-hmm. And here in Michigan, you see the same thing. There are lots of family farms still because we're such a diverse state in terms of the types of things that we grow.
Very good. Well, thank you for answering that question. And listeners, if you have a question for the Garden Guy, you can email him directly. Gary Heilig's, his email address is Heilig, H-E-I-L-I-G, at msu.edu. And again, Heilig, H-E-I-L-I-G, at Michigan State, msu.edu. So, Gary, it's become quite a tradition to have a quiz, so... go ahead. You didn't even give us any clues what it might be.
Well, that's because the first question should help you to understand that. And the first question is, what nut is actually not a nut?
That would be the peanut.
That's right. It's peanuts are legumes, which is the same family as peas and beans, alfalfa, crown vetch, and things of that sort. This one will be a little bit of a guess. I thought about making it multiple choice, but I said, nah.
You don't want to help us out.
Yeah. About how many peanuts are needed for a jar of peanut butter?
Wow.
That would be that medium-sized jar, not a little tiny jar.
Well, you know, my wife says that to me and the boys ask questions she never thinks about. But, Gary, you just taught me on that one. I never think about how many peanuts are in the peanut
butter. I didn't either until I started doing the research for this.
Okay. Well, Sue, why don't you take the first guess?
I'll give you one hint. That, it's less than 1,000.
Oh, thank you. Okay, good.
Well, let's see. How about 250 peanuts?
Okay, what's your guess, Tom?
Well, I'm just trying to think of what a whole peanut looks like. And,
don't forget, you can get more of them in there when you grind them up.
That's true. That's
yeah,
true.
Yeah, the shells wouldn't be included in that.
No,
that's
not unless you want inedible peanut butter.
Yeah.
I'm going to say 500 peanuts.
You hit it right on the money.
Well, praise the Lord. That was a good estimate.
That sure was. Okay, our next one is, what two presidents were peanut farmers?
Well, I know one, Jimmy Carter.
Jimmy Carter. Okay, who else?
And
it would be within the first five presidents.
I think it's Jefferson.
Yeah, exactly right.
I would agree with that.
Thomas Jefferson. Okay, what is the nickname for peanuts?
Goober peas.
Goobers.
Yeah, actually it's goobers. It comes from a word from the Congo called Naguba. And, of course, we all sang that song in school, Goober Peas. I think that was during Civil War time that people sang that. Now, who was considered the grandfather of peanuts?
I would say that's George Washington.
George Washington Carver.
That's right. He came up with all different types of ways to use peanuts. Now, he didn't invent peanut butter. Peanut butter was actually invented by Bob Skippy Johnson and Jiffy Bonnet.
That's, oh, no
that
way.
That is a joke.
I don't think so. The two warring ones that I know of they're saying for Dr. Kellogg or that other guy in Iowa.
I just thought Bob Skippy Johnson would be good. Funny. Okay.
Was that a distractor question?
Kind of, yeah. A little attempted humor here.
Okay.
Where do peanuts fall in the rating of the most valuable U.S. crops? It has to be within 1 to 20.
Are we talking about dollars or are we talking about bushels?
Value would mean, you know, dollars. Yeah.
Wow.
So like a gross national product type thing.
1 to 20.
Well, let's see. Corn is pretty big stuff, and wheat is pretty big stuff.
I'll give you a hint. It's not in the top 10.
Okay, okay. 19.
Sue, what's your guess?
I'm going to say 20.
It's 18.
You got
pretty close. But with that 18, we still export 200,000 tons a year.
So who's eating all those peanuts?
Well, the average person eats about 6 pounds of peanuts and peanut butter a year. Now, who's eating all the peanuts? Well, we're all the people.
Well, I'm going to say it's all the kids.
Yeah, because, you know, I never did like peanut butter and jelly sandwiches. No. Okay, next one is, this one is really interesting. How old is a planter's mascot? You know, the little peanut guy?
Yeah.
And what is the name of his car?
I
didn't know he had a car.
Yes, he does. I saw a picture of for some reason, this is something to sound like Sue. I read something about that.
I'll give you a hint on part of it. It's not the Batmobile.
Okay. No, literally, I was looking at that and I got off on that tangent looking at him. They have modified him from time to time throughout the years.
Yeah, they've modernized him.
I would say it was the Nutmobile.
It is the Nutmobile and the planter.
Oh, Tom, that's good.
You know,
like
that's
kind
of obvious. And the planter peanut, the mascot, how old do you think he is?
He is at least, he's, I'd say, 80 years old.
Sue?
I'm going to be a little more conservative. I'll maybe say 60.
Actually, over 100 years.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, really?
That's an old dude. Okay, how many types of peanuts are there? And I'm not talking about varieties here. I'm talking about types. Like if we were talking about types of corn, we would have sweet corn, dent corn, popcorn, field corn, that type of thing. So how many types of peanuts do you think there are?
There's I think it's 2 or 3. I know there's all different strains of it, but there's Valencia and what's the other one? Virginia?
Valencia's one. Yeah. Virginia's another one. Think of foreign country. Think of foreign country.
Spanish.
Yeah. Spanish. And then the last one is called runner. And the runner is the dominant type. And there's a variety called floor runner that was brought in the 1970s, and it really increased peanut yields a lot because of it. It has an attractive uniform kernel size, and about 54% of the ones that are grown from these varieties are made into peanut butter. And they grow primarily in Georgia, Florida, Alabama, Texas, and Oklahoma. The Virginia peanut is grown in southeastern Virginia, and northeastern North Carolina and South Carolina. And the Virginia peanuts have the largest kernel. And most of these are roasted and processed in the shell. And they're sold for like gourmet snacks and those types of things. Then the Spanish peanut and the Valencias both have a little reddish brown skin covering them. And actually, that probably bothers some people, but I really like it. It doesn't bother me at all. And those are used in peanut candies, the Spanish ones. And this one has a higher oil content. So when you get peanut oil, most likely there's at least some Spanish peanuts in there. And those are primarily grown in Oklahoma and Texas. And then the last one, the Valencias, those are where when you see peanuts that have 3 or more kernels, you think you hit the jackpot? Well, those are the Valencias. But the kernels are a little smaller. And these are the sweetest of the peanuts. And they're usually roasted or sold in the shell, and you can eat them fresh, or if you go down south, they will boil them. And these are primarily grown in New Mexico.
You know, it's just you actually answered the question I was going to ask you is how many, I didn't know they were called kernels, but how many kernels do they have? And, you know, most of the ones that we ate growing up had 2 kernels, but you know, once in a while there was a single kernel, and once in a while 3.
I have seen 4 once, but they're really small when they're that many. Okay, here's the next one. What is the history on the phrase peanut gallery?
Well, I think that it had to do with, I'm just going to guess. I'm going to say that this was the poor section where the people, it was less expensive in the bleachers and the people bought
for the
peanuts.
Circus and so on.
Oh, that's a good idea. I was going to say baseball game, but go ahead.
Well, it's from the 1800s, and people that were sitting in the audience in the upper level decks at the theater, when they didn't like something, either what they're hearing or seeing, they'd throw the peanuts at the stage. And so they called it the Peanut Gallery. Okay, who do you think are the top world producers of peanuts?
Well, it must be...
Let's see if you can get the first two.
Africa. And that's a continent, so I...
Yeah. We're talking about countries here. Okay. Sue, what do you think?
We have to say Congo and the United States.
Could be
Mexico, too.
I was going to say it's got to be somewhere warm. They got to have warm climate there. So it is Mexico or India or some of the countries in Africa.
Well, India's number two at 13%, but number one is China.
China's never going to get, it's always going to be there.
No, it's not. Their population is supposed to drop by about 600 million by the year 2100, which none of us will be here. But they produce about 37% of the global total. And other countries that produce notable amounts would be Nigeria, Sudan, Senegal, Burma, Guyana, Argentina, Tanzania. The United States didn't come in the top producers. So there must be a lot of peanuts eating around the world.
Well, here's a question for you on this quiz, and it's on topic. Where do peanuts originate from? Tom, you know this because we read it in The Precious Cargo.
Of course I did, and I've duly forgot.
I think it's Africa, but I'm not sure.
That's what everybody thinks. That's what they told us in school. It turns out to be wrong.
Oh, my goodness.
Well, yes, you know what?
I'm not infallible like the Pope.
they originated from South America.
I'm not surprised. Did they say what country?
And they got it shipped. There was discussion about Aztec and Inca, the different. I was surprised because, they had the Portuguese were barging about the globe sooner than they used to think. And so they actually took it over to feed some of their colonies in Africa, and it just mushroomed there and became a huge crop there. And so everybody thought it originated from Africa, but it wasn't.
What I want to know, Sue, is since corn came from the New World too, did they invent Cracker Jacks?
I think that's
American.
That would
be good. I used to love, Grandpa used to buy, because there was three of us grandkids, and he would buy the little three-pack of Cracker Jack. It was perfect. We loved that.
Well, folks,
I know. Let's try this out on Tom, Gary. Tom,
we might have to do this in segment two. We're out of time.
Okay, listeners, you just wait for a minute, and we'll be back with the Sue's quiz question. This is Tom Majeure, your host for Good Growing for the Garden Guide. My sister, Sue Majeure, and Gary Heilig. We'll be right back.
The Bible and God's character are under attack like never before. Here at Strong Tower Radio, we are proud to hold up the Bible as a lamp unto our feet and a light unto our path. We believe the Bible is the Word of God and contains the good news of God's character and His great plan of salvation for mankind. If you know and believe this to be true, won't you help Strong Tower Radio proclaim the truth about our God and His Word, the Bible? To do that, go to www.strongtowerradio.org, and there, on our secure website, you will find a donate button. Click on that and give as the Lord directs. Thank you for listening and supporting Strong Tower Radio, where God's character is proclaimed.
We're back with Good Growing with the Garden Guy, Gary Heilig, Sue Majeure, and yours truly, Tom Majeure. Now, Sue was doing a turnabout on Gary and posing a question, a quiz question to Gary. Sue, it's your turn to stump the garden guy.
That's I think that Gary might have he might have come across it in his research, but I'll test the both of you. What legal percentage of your peanut butter must be peanuts?
90%.
That's a good question. 95%.
Give Gary a Kewpie doll. It is 90%, and it was thought out by the peanut companies against the housewife, who said that we shouldn't be feeding our children stuff that has other things, and then you can't call it peanut butter unless it has all of the peanuts. And they fought back and forth over this issue in Congress and everything else for like 10 years before they decided on 90%.
You know, with modern food processors, it's very easy to make your own peanut butter.
Sure.
But anyway, I have two more questions for you guys.
Well, you know, just it sounded like me to me that this battle in Congress was the great peanut butter war.
Yeah, we're going to talk about that in a few minutes. We're going to be talking a lot about peanuts today.
But anyway, really? Okay.
So what do you think some of the top states are for peanut production?
Georgia.
That's right. They grow about 42% of all U.S. peanuts. And who else do you think? And I've mentioned some of these already.
Right.
I think Alabama and Mississippi would have the proper
That's
climate.
Right. Mm-hmm. In Florida?
Isn't there a small percentage of the, I forget which variety, that they grow like in Arizona, New Mexico, and some of the warm parts there?
Yeah, the last one that we talked about, the Valencia, I believe it was, most of it's grown in New Mexico, but also some are grown in, of course, Virginia, North and South Carolina, and Oklahoma. Now, the next one is, can you think of some industrial uses of the peanut?
Well, I would think the oil would be used for, couldn't you use it for greasing gears and other type of things?
Yeah, it could be used as a lubricating oil.
And I suppose they won't use it in cosmetics because some people have allergies.
Well, it is used in cosmetics, but they probably have to be very careful about that. Maybe the allergen's not in the oil, but it is used in cosmetics. It's used in soaps. It's used in furniture polish, insecticides, varnish, paint, leather dressings. So there's, and the shells are used in making plastics, wallboard, abrasives, rayon, and the cellulose is used for paper, mucilage, fuel, and of course you can compost them. So there's a lot that can be done.
So do they use the peanut, it's the kernel for the, it sounded like you talked about the oil, but what about?
Yeah, it's the peanut itself that they're getting some of these things out. And then when I said the peanut shells, that's when we talked about the plastics, the wallboard, abrasives, and that type of thing. Here's my next question. Can you grow, and this is the final one, can you grow peanuts in Michigan?
I saw that.
Not commercially and industrially, can you? I would think the ground would need to be warmer.
Well, the big thing, we will have warm enough ground, but the big
duration.
Thing is how many days, frost-free days, do you have? And peanuts require 130 to 160 frost-free days to grow.
Oh.
And so what do we do if we have a real long thing like that? How do we get around that?
You'd have to grow it in a hoop house or something.
Right. You started like a transplant, like tomatoes or peppers or something like that. So you can grow them in Michigan, but you do have to start the plants just like you would start tomatoes or peppers. And when you put the seeds in, they'll come up within about a week. And they will start to form branches, and they'll bloom about 4 to 6 weeks later, and it has a yellow bloom on it. And when the plant has been fertilized, or I should say the flower's been fertilized, then it starts to produce something called a peg. And it's also called a gynophore. And I like peg better. But anyway, it drops down from the flower, what's left from the flower, and goes into the soil. And what a peg is, it's a specialized organ that looks like a tube, And that's at the edge of this. This is where the actual peanut will form, but it forms underground. And after you've reached the proper amount of time that the peanut's growing, like 160 days, then you can harvest it, and you'll get about 50 peanuts per plant. And you harvest this when the plants begin to yellow. You just pull the whole thing up and hang the plant upside down in a warm place like a garage or something like that, or a barn, for about 2 weeks. And then if you want to eat them fresh, you can. But if you want to roast them, you need to put them in the 350-degree oven for 15 to 20 minutes if they've been shelled, and 20 to 25 minutes if they're still in the shells.
So, do you have any plans to grow peanuts in Michigan?
I might try it this year, and I want to see if I could get all four types, but I have to get on Amazon and see if I could find the seeds. But the other thing, here's something interesting. Did you know that in 2002 Farm Bill, it requires all peanuts to be marketed in the United States to be inspected and graded by federal inspectors or federally licensed state inspectors? And they're looking for the quality of peanuts, make sure it doesn't have molds on them, because molds can produce aflatoxins, which are poisonous. And so you will need a license if you plan on distributing your peanuts or the seeds or any products that you make from your peanuts. And if you get caught doing this, I guess they say you can have some very high fines, but I don't know. I couldn't find out how high the fines were. So when I thought about it, it says distributing, that would indicate that you couldn't even legally give somebody seeds that you've grown yourself if you want to be on the safe side. So that's something you need to be aware of. You're not going to grow peanuts here and say Michigan peanuts without them being inspected, if you want to stay out of trouble.
I'm not surprised at that, because in that Creamy and Crunchy book, there was quite a long discussion about the inspections and that toxin, and there was a lot of argument about that.
Yeah, well, aflatoxins are quite nasty, so I think I would want to have my stuff inspected, because liability issues could be shared if the government screwed up. All right, anyway, moving on.
Okay, Gary, let's talk about getting soils ready for planting.
Well, the soils have been rather dry here in Michigan, and I've been watching the fields, and a lot of the farmers have been turning their fields over. And the reason they do that is it helps any residual to break down faster, and it can, to a certain extent, decrease the incidence of certain types of diseases. I haven't done that yet. I'm still clearing out my garden, but what I will do is I'll take my soil test, send it to the university, and then I will put down my phosphorus and potassium, because it stays where you put it for a while as opposed to nitrogen. That's a little different. And then I'll turn that all under, and then when I get ready to plant, they'll still be there and ready to go. And then all I'll have to use is my third of nitrogen for the season. So, other than that, if you have compost and you want to put it in and work it in, you should do that before you till. And actually, you should actually put your compost down, till, and then take your soil test, because then they can take that into consideration. And the same thing would be true if you're adding an animal manure, like you have cow manure, chicken manure, or something like that, that herbivores, not cat and dog and that sort of stuff. And so they'll take those things into consideration when they're making the fertilizer recommendations. And of course, if you're spreading fresh manure, it's going to be at least 30 days before you can start putting food plants in there.
That you would harvest, you know?
Yeah. And they're short season things like radishes, lettuce, and lettuce, and all kinds of greens that you'd have to wait at least a month before you'd even get those started.
So what can we plant outdoors in April?
Well, you can put onions in, your onion seeds, you can peas. You can put peas in March. I think we might have mentioned that last month. Lettuce, various types of greens. And the seeds, especially if they're treated seeds, will sit there and they'll be okay. I mean, if it's colder soil, then you have a greater chance of losing a larger percentage of seeds. But one of the things that I always suggest people do is have a soil thermometer and check the soil temperature at the depth that you plan on planting the seeds and see if it falls within the range for that particular plant. Because the name of the game is getting those seeds up quickly.
Does that mean that having a plant meter would be very useful?
When you say a plant meter, you mean a moisture meter?
Well, I was kind of thinking one I got for Tom. It checks the moisture and the pH and the fertilizer and something else.
Temperature, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Well, that time of year, temperature is going to be the most dependable thing. In terms of the pH, you really have to check your meter with known reagents. So, for instance, you get one that is 4 pH, which is quite acidic, and another one that's 7, and you check your meter with both of those. And you want to make sure it's clean, pour distilled water on it before you put it in there, and then rinse it off with distilled water before you go to the other reagent, and so that you can find out how accurate your pH meter is. Because a tenth of a point can make a difference. In terms of it telling you how much fertilizer, that's a little bit more difficult to do. I'd have to look at his meter to see what it's like. If it tested parts per million of various things, what I would do is take a soil test, run it through the university, and then compare the results of your meter with the university soil test so that you can get an idea how accurate it is.
It sounds like a good idea. You mentioned greens. Are we talking about kale and...
Yeah, kale, anything in the cabbage family can take a light frost. And with
our broccolis and our
Normally you're going to be growing them in a greenhouse. You're not going to put those out until the end of the season, because unless you start them really early, like in January, they're not going to be large enough to put out in the garden. But you could start, if you were going to grow collards from seed, you could put those in. Mustard would be a little more tender. But I'm thinking if I was going to try mustard early, it's going to be more toward late April than earlier April. And for instance, as we're talking now, we're toward the end of March. Tomorrow we're supposed to get 4 inches of snow.
Right.
So that's not real. That's not real conducive to seed germination. But by by mid to late April, then you're going to get some decent temperatures in the soil.
Okay. Let's talk about finishing our fruit tree pruning.
Well, not only tree fruits, but small fruits also. In April, as you remember, I tell people always wait on the stone fruits, which would be the peaches, nectarines, apricots, plums, cherries, because they're a little bit more likely to be damaged by cold weather late. And so if you're getting damaged late, then I would cut back on my pruning so that you have more flowers and fruit. If, for instance, this year it's been pretty nice, so unless we get something really late, I'm not too worried about the status of the flower buds. But also, this is prime time to get your blueberries pruned. And also, April's a good time to fertilize your blueberries. And remember, you need acidic fertilizers like ammonium sulfate 2100 or potassium sulfate 0050 for blueberries. And this is a time to prune brambles. Now, for instance, I have everbears. I have a choice right now. I had cut everything down after they produced last year. So everything that's going to produce this year, it'll produce a smaller crop on the canes that are there now, and then new canes will come up this year. And then when the July raspberries are over, I would cut those down. Or I can cut them all down and then let them come back up, and then I'll start getting more raspberries in August. I have that choice with the everbears. Whereas with the red raspberries, they will produce the primal cane the first year, and then they'll produce the floral cane, which is the cane that has the fruit on it the second year. And you can tell which ones had fruit last year. Cut those off at the ground. And then if you have very vigorous red raspberries or golden raspberries, if they're higher than about 5 feet, if you want to cut them back a little bit, you can, especially if you're not giving them any support. And you will lose a little bit of fruit, but if you want to keep them upright, you may want to trim them back to about 5 feet. With the with black raspberries and purple raspberries, if you did it right last year, when the primal canes came up, you should have cut them off at about 3 feet. Then you would have had the lateral branches. And in the spring, what you do is cut the lateral branches back to about 8 to 10 inches. And then those will have nice compact fruit in a much smaller area. And in terms of grapes, grapes are a little different. You only need to have a cane that's 1 year old that's going to produce fruit this year. And depending on what kind of a system you have will determine how many you have. For instance, if you have what's called a four-cane niffin system, you'll have two going each direction off of the main trunk at the top and two down at the bottom. And then you select four more as close to those four fruiting canes that you have, and you trim those back to two buds. That's going to be what's called a renewal spur. And that's where you're going to get new fruiting canes for the following year. But there are lots of other types of pruning systems that you may do something a little bit different. Like there's umbrella niffin, Geneva double curtain, and you do things a little differently with each of those. And you'd have to go online to see how you trim some of those. But this is the prime time to do it in April.
What about applying dormant oils?
One of the reasons I put that in there is a lot of times people will apply dormant oils and then you ask them why you're doing it and they have no idea. Dormant oils are for overwintering insects like scale or certain types of aphids that overwinter on the tree itself. If you've had, say, a magnolia tree where the chairs under it were coated with a black mold, that's called sooty mold, and that's an indication that you have magnolia scale. And they're there now. And so when the temperatures get up to about 40 degrees during the day and you don't expect it to freeze at night, that's when you mix up the dormant oil or what they call superior oil if you're buying something like Ortho's Volk oil. You spray this on the tree and cover it totally, and it will prevent those overwintering scales from getting oxygen, and they'll be smothered. And you can knock scale numbers down that way. The same thing's done on fruit trees. They're different types of scale that get on fruit trees too. The one that causes the biggest problem causes little red spots on your fruit. You normally will see it at the base. It's called San Jose scale. And you either hit them in the spring when the scale are there, which they're very small, they're about the size of the head of a pin, or you wait until the crawlers come out, which are the babies, and you're going to need a little help on that by checking with MSU, and then you treat with an appropriate insecticide, and you can kill the babies before they have a chance to settle down and start to make that waxy coating that protects them from most chemicals.
Hmm. What about diseases such as scab?
There are a number of different scabs. There's scab that get on peaches, scab that get on pear, scab that gets on apple. And usually fungal diseases do the best as it warms up and you have long periods of time of wet leaves. So when you're expecting, say, 2 or 3 days of rain, you want to put on a protective fungicide to decrease the amount of infection that you're going to get. And if you get a good hard rain of more than a half inch of water, you may have to reapply it afterwards. It just depends on how long the leaves are wet. Now, on peaches, you have something called peach leaf curl, and you have to use a fungicide on that just as the buds are starting to swell. Early April is when you have to do that. And that can cut down on those crinkly leaves that turn brown and fall off. And also, there's another disease called brown rot that causes all the stone fruits to get this light, puffy fungal disease that can spread very quickly. And you start very early, usually a little bit before bloom. Now, the only thing that's going to bloom in April is apricots. But if you've had a problem with brown rot, you certainly want to get that spray on the apricots. You could wait a little bit longer on peaches and plums and things.
Okay, it's time for a break. Listeners, this is Good Growing with the Garden Guy, Gary Heilig, Sue Majeure, and Tom Majeure. We'll be back after this.
Hi folks, Jelaine Fenner here. We are definitely living in uncertain times, and for some of us, it's scary. Signs of the times are everywhere. Jesus is coming back soon. Read Revelation chapter 22. Jesus says, "Surely I am coming quickly." We at Strong Tower Radio have a free book for you called The Great Controversy. Go to the back of the book and read chapters 35 to 42. It'll help you understand the times we're living in and what's ahead. This book even has 800 historical quotes and 1,200 Bible quotes. I love this book. Call Strong Tower Radio today, 231-468-2087, and ask for The Great Controversy while supplies last. And if we don't answer, please leave a message asking for The Great Controversy with your name, address, and phone number. That's 231-468-2087. On Strong Tower Radio, where God's character is proclaimed.
We're back with Good Growing with the Garden Guy, Gary Heilig, Sue Majeure, Tom Majeure. Well, Gary, we were talking about trees, and what about planting new trees?
Well, there are a couple of things you want to consider. First of all, you need to make sure that you have full sunlight all day, preferably at least 8 hours or more. And take a look at what the trees and other structures are around, because as trees get older, they'll cast a longer shadow. Another thing is you want to be sure that the soils are the proper soils, and drainage is probably the biggest thing. And we've talked about doing a drainage test, but dig a hole, pour some water in it, maybe 16 inches or so, let it drain out, pour it in a second time, and see how long it takes for it to drain out. If it's gone within a couple of hours, you're fine. But if it's there a couple of days, then you might want to go someplace else. Although you can grow apples and pears in soils that are a little wetter, they'll be saturated in the spring and they'll do fine. But you do that with peaches and cherries and things like that, they won't do so well.
Now you talk about that. I remember going out and harvesting in an orchard, and sometimes there could be some soggy areas.
Yeah, and you'll find that the wetter the soil is, even with the apples and pears, I think pears do a little bit better than apples, but the apples tend to not grow as well. Because in my orchard, there's a slant toward the north, and it's a little lower toward the north than it is in the south. And the trunks are much larger in the southern part of the orchard than they are in the northern part of the orchard. So you want good drainage if possible. Also, you want fresh soil. You don't want to replant where there was apple trees or peach trees or any of those things before, because of what's called replant disease, and it's not well understood, but the trees don't do very well. And I have planted some trees in areas where there were trees before just to see what would happen, and they just don't get as big. They're very slow to produce, and so they are affected.
My question is there a dormancy? For instance, the property, part of my property was an orchard. Many decades. It's been fallow for quite a few years. Is there a period of time that...
When I was doing research on that, I never found a specific time. Now, if somebody had fumigated the soil, then you might be able to do it without much trouble, because fumigation takes out everything, and then, of course, you'd have to reintroduce the beneficial things. But they're, like I said, they don't really know what the problem is. So, for instance, with peaches, I know that root knot nematode, which is a microscopic worm, can be a problem, and it can build up in the soils where peaches were before, and then if you planted peaches there again, the root knot nematode is going to cause a lot of trouble. But most people wouldn't know that, and they say, why aren't my peaches growing? So normally if somebody's going to start a peach orchard, they will run a nematode test to find out if they have to treat before they plant.
But
we don't really know what it is for the other things.
I mean, there's only one tree left in that area, and it looks like it's near 100 years old. I mean, it's ancient.
The only way you could find out, Tom, would be to plant one there and see, does it do well? Or does it just kind of grow very slowly?
Okay.
And then, of course, the other thing you want to make sure is put the tree in a place where you can keep an eye on it, because you'll have things that are going to go after it, like deer and rabbits, and you're going to have to do some protective things. So, but now is a prime time, and if you've ordered fruit trees, they're going to start coming through the mail. And if you can't plant them right away, then you should put them in pots. Don't just leave them bare root someplace, because they'll dry out and die very quickly.
You know, you're talk about different things, getting at the trees and such. I've noticed somebody had a plastic netting around the tree. Rather, some of them have been solid materials as a barrier.
Mm-hmm.
I just thought that was interesting to have a plastic netting that went around the tree, maybe half inch or inch square, and wrap that around the tree to protect the bark.
That can make it a little bit more difficult. Normally they have plastic wraps for the trunks, and those need to be left on during the winter months, but you take them off during the spring, usually about May, and then you don't have to worry about the rabbits anymore because they now have plenty of food to feed on. But during the winter months, they'll take the bark right off all the way around. Deer like to feed on young branches, and if you're in the process of trying to train your tree, then that's not going to work very well if the deer are chewing off everything you're trying to do.
What about roses? I know that's one of your favorite subjects.
Well, a lot of times people want to grow roses, but they don't know that you can get into a situation where it's too much work versus not a lot of work at all. For instance, there are many different types of roses. The classic hybrid teas are those long stem roses that most people think about when they're getting flowers for right. Mother's Day, but then there are floribundas or grandifloras. There are all kinds of heritage roses, and many of the heritage roses not only have nice smells to them, but they're more resistant to various diseases like black spot. A lot of our modern hybrids are more susceptible to things like black spot, and you're going to have to treat them for these things. You also have to realize that things like Japanese beetles love to feed on roses, and they're hard to keep under control. But again, with some of the older roses, they don't particularly care for that. So especially shrub roses and climbers, you don't see as much damage from insects and diseases. And you can still get nice roses with fragrant with some of the older ones. So if you're not willing to put on protective material during the winter, if you're not willing to spray for insects and diseases, then you need to be selective on what roses you get. And in most places, like if you're close to Lansing, you can go to MSU and you can see all the different roses and see what kind of diseases they get. And or if you go to an arboretum like down at University of Michigan or some of the other gardens around here and in Indiana, you can get some hints. But one of the things that I'm very much interested in, if I'm going to get a rose, I want it to smell like something. There's nothing like bringing in a bouquet of fragrant roses. It just fills the room with the smell. And it's so nice. It's just really nice.
Well,
Are there any plants that like to companion plant? Like, for example, Tom puts basil with his tomatoes because some of the pests don't like it as much. Is there anything that you can plant with your roses to help them out?
I've never heard of anything that the thing about plants deterring certain insects, it's more that the insect doesn't prefer that particular plant. I've not seen a lot of research that shows that it really keeps the insects away in a big way. Although there are some examples, for instance, there are certain types of marigolds that will excrete chemicals into the soil that will deter nematodes. But, you know, the jury's out as to how effective companion planting is. And a lot of people will say, oh, I swear by it. But that's not research. That's observational. And research is quite different. And they do analysis and everything, mathematical analysis to determine, are we really having an effect? But if it works for you, do it. I mean, I'm not against it at all. If you're seeing results, then go ahead and try it.
Now, Gary,
are there any plants that just look or grow well in the same type of beds and so on that the roses do that are common to plant together?
The biggest thing I would suggest is don't put such large plants in there that the root system is competing with the roses. Like when we were growing roses, we would put alyssum around the edges of the roses, and it worked really well in the bed, but their roots were so small that they didn't really steal any nutrients from the roses. Because roses in Michigan are already at a disadvantage, because if you see roses growing out in California, for instance, you get to August and they're like 4 to 5 feet tall. And here in Michigan, they'll be half of that height. So they really like the warm weather. And so I wouldn't do anything that would compete with them for water or nutrients. So keep the plants small that you have as companion plants.
Gary, you mentioned about that you could do some research or look at plants in an arboretum. You mentioned Michigan State University. There's multiple gardens on Michigan State University, and it's a big campus. Where would you go to look at these roses to kind of compare and say, hey, I would like to have that particular
They
rose.
Do have a rose garden.
Okay.
And then in the perennial garden, they do have some shrub roses that are right on the edge of the perennial garden moving into the rose garden.
So for this rose garden, do you go to a campus directory, Google it? How do you find this rose garden?
The rose garden is on the west side or southwest side of the Plant and Soil Sciences building and greenhouses. And if you go to any map online, it'll show you exactly where it is. And the different roses are labeled. And the best time to go to look at the roses is June. That's when they have their first and biggest bloom.
Okay, so June, Michigan State University, or any rose garden, demonstration rose garden. And
I would go online, and wherever you may happen to be, you might say, if you're in Indiana, you might say, rose gardens in Indiana, and then you'll find out who has them.
Very good. I see that you are going to be at the Michigan camp meeting at Cedar Lake, and you'll be doing a small fruit series.
Yeah, I'll be teaching on Tuesday on through the rest of the week. There'll be four sessions, and each session will be 2 hours long. And then the first day will be strawberries. Second day will be brambles, not just raspberries. And then the third day will be blueberries, and the fourth day will be grapes.
All right.
So in 2 hours, you can get a pretty good idea. At first, they were talking about doing a class in a day, and I said, if you really want to teach people how to grow, you're going to need at least 2 hours per fruit.
Very good. So look forward to that at the Michigan camp meeting at Cedar Lake, Tuesday through Friday. And let's talk about moving those indoor plants outside.
Well, April is a little early. But the reason I put it in here is if, say, for instance, you've had something that's really suffered during the winter and it needs light badly, then when you have some nice warm days, you could set them out. But just remember, they need to be set out in the shade. And you need to be...
Because the direct sunlight that they're not
used to. Yeah, they won't be able to take direct sunlight for at least 10 days, because when a plant is inside, its waxy coating or the cuticle gets very thin. And when it's exposed to the sunlight over time, that cuticle gets thicker, and it can handle that light. And also, the sunlight itself will cause sunburn and can really bleach the leaves. So they have to be in shade, but you also have to take into consideration the temperature, because in April, it can still get quite cool. But as you get down to later April, then you get nice temperatures during the day. You might have to bring something in at night. Some things make it a little better than others. Like coleus won't take any cold weather, but some of the begonias will, depending on what type of begonia it is, the thicker leaf begonias will take a little cooler weather. But when you start getting around 40 degrees, you want to start thinking of taking stuff in.
We need to slip the next one. In fact, this is the most important of the whole program to me, and it's how to do the least amount of work in your veggie garden.
It takes planning, because you have to think about, what do you spend most of your time doing once you have the garden in? Probably number one is weeding. And then number two is watering. And then number three is fighting the pests. So what I suggest people do is, when you plant, put down your mulches as soon as you're finished doing a row. And if you can, get rid of the perennial weeds before you do all of this. If you can afford it, you can put down black plastic right now in April, and then by the time you're ready to start working the garden, a lot of those weeds that would have come up would have died out from lack of light. But what we like to do is, say, for instance, I'm going to plant a row of tomatoes. we'll put down the tomatoes, and then we will put down the landscape fabric in the row, and then outside the row, we'll put down a row of newspaper and then straw. And then the other thing we'll do is we'll put down our irrigation, our drip irrigation right away. And the drip irrigation does two things. One, it puts the water just where you want it. So if you're not using an overhead sprinkler, you're not watering the ground where new seeds from weeds will come up. So by targeting where you put your water, then you may get a few weed seeds, but just pulling up a few in a row, especially with a mulch down, is a lot easier. And I've talked about this before, but with certain plants, especially greens, like as your broccoli is short and your cabbage is short, anything in the cabbage family, to keep things off of it, if you don't want to do a lot of spraying, put a row cover over it and sprinkle some coffee grounds around the plant so that if you have any slugs in the garden, they'll eat that and that'll kill them. And of course, you'll have your mulch down and you won't have to do much of anything there. Also, when you put in a row of something, let's say you want to put in a row of spinach, one of the things we try to do sometimes is make a wider row. So instead of a single row of plants, we might make a row that's three wide, which will take up more space, and that's space where you're not going to have weeds growing.
Okay.
So if you're planning ahead and you do all of these different things, you'll find that the amount of work that you have to do is a lot less. Now, in terms of the pests, you're still going to have to deal with pests, especially diseases. And by having that irrigation, you're not wetting the top leaves. So unless you have a wet year, you're going to have less disease pressure. And stay on top of it. You know, most of your fungicides are only going to last about 5 to 7 days, tops. So if you stay on your plan, then you're not going to have to come back in there and, you know, take diseases out. And then be prepared when an insect comes and know exactly what you plan on doing and just be ready to hit them right away. And if it's all about planning and timing. But if you deal with that water and the weed issue, you'd be surprised how much less time you'll spend in that garden working.
Totally. I agree. Real quickly, about 30 seconds of spring lawn care.
Well, the first thing is April is a good time for seeding. Just work up the soil a little bit. Even if you have grass there, you can just rake the soil a little bit, put the seed down, put a bale of straw down, one bale per 1,000 square feet if you have something that large, put a little fertilizer down. Be sure there are no grubs in the soil. If there are, you might want to put an insecticide down like 7. If you're organic, you might be a little stuck, but put extra seed there because they will eat the seed. And also, this is a time for pre-emergence weed control. And if you want to do it organically, you can use corn gluten meal. And that will do as good a job as some of the other things, especially as you're doing that year after year.
What, the corn?
Corn gluten meal.
Where do you get that?
You can buy that in a preparation. What is the name of that stuff?
Is it Preen?
No, it's not Preen. Preen is something else. I'm having a little senior moment here. But anyway, it's right on the top of my tongue.
You can get them at
garden centers, yeah. It just ask for the corn gluten meal.
Okay, very good. Well, folks, that concludes Good Growing for the Garden Guy April. Stay tuned. And if you have any questions in between, you can email them to Gary at Heilig@MichiganState.edu. That's MSU.edu. Well, until next month, this is Gary Heilig, Tom Majeure, and Sue Majeure wishing you good growing. Bye now.